Okay, good evening. Thank you everybody for coming. It's Popeyes is evening, right? Even though it's still really bright outside. This time of the year. So I'm just wondering, show of hands here, how many people here have heard of Rav Chaim Kahl, the character of tonight's shir? You've heard the book, yeah. And you've heard the name. Okay, so you've probably heard some of the background. The way the story, in some ways, is more prominent than the book, but the book is very there's much to point out there. I have a somewhat personal relationship, and that is the translator of the English book, Rabbi Moshe Lichtman, was my when I went to Mevaseret was my Rebbe slash Kavrusa for the year while he was writing the book. So I got translating the book. So I got a full all the frustrations as he was going through it. It took him 3 years to translate it, and I have my own copy with my own inscription, which makes me feel very guilty. Don't withstand the temptation of staying in Galus, and we'll come back here, and then we'll finish Shas together. Hopefully we'll be able to get to that point a few times. That it's not impossible. It hasn't happened yet. Okay, so to place. Rav Teichthal. Rav Teichthal is part of the Hungarian world, perhaps not as well known to many of us, just simply because the Torah world thrust of the United States is really inched towards the north. More Lithuanian yeshivas, more the Polish Hasidim perhaps are a little bit more prominent. So some of the names that one comes across perhaps are not as familiar, but there actually are some personal connections there for me as well. So he grew up Hungary more than Poland, more than Russia, certainly more than Lithuania, and more than Germany, all these other places, was really staunchly anti-Zionist. That was already a period, the 1800s, 1900s, that was the period of the first Aliyah, second Aliyah, third Aliyah, and by the Rabbanim of Hungary were very adamantly against anything having to do with that. So it's just important, why? What was their main opposition? So, for that you have to go a little bit further back in time for where the roots of such opposition were. For thousands of years people have been davening that hope is a chazen ha'ininu shuvcha tzion yachav rachamim, that we should be able to go back to Israel, and then somewhat of an opportunity came, and there was a nervousness to participate with that. So what were the main objections? So you have to go back, a lot of it emanates, and a lot of the issues that we see today between various religious groups, Orthodox, even within the Orthodox world, a lot of it harkens back to the period of Shabtai Tzvi, and Shabtai Tzvi, the issues surrounding it. Shabtai Tzvi is somewhat of a response to a very difficult time in Jewish history, the Chmielnitsky uprising. It's been told to me that before Chmielnitsky was a group that came from the east, the Cossacks, they killed anywhere from 100 to 500,000 Jews in a not a very long amount of time. Perhaps a future person for Profiles Persecution might be the Shah, who spent his not too many years running away from the Cossacks. He writes a few times, Shah is a big, big, important character in our halachic history. He writes a few times, I'm running away from them. So European Jewry was in shambles when that follows. Following that, they kind of gathered together and then rally around somebody named Shabtai Tzvi, claimed to be Mashiach, claimed to be that this is going to be the end of all of our suffering, to the point that people were selling their houses and people were saying, why do I bother? I don't have to worry about these business deals. Mashiach's going to come tomorrow. We're going to leave. And then Shabtai Tzvi converts to Islam, and there's a lot of disheartening amongst the Jewish people. That leads to the Yaakov Emden Eibishitz controversies, which perhaps leads to the split amongst Hasidim and Mishnah. A lot of it can be traced to those pressures. And to the point that there is a great fear amongst the Rabbanim that any attempt, anything close to a Messianism could lead us down that path, and therefore it needs to be avoided. So perhaps that is the number one nervousness having to do with this, and that it has to be, is that this perhaps echoes of Messianism, and that leads to bad things for the Jewish people. Another thing is that also during that period is the rise of the Reform Movement, the rise of the Haskalah, the Reform Movement, and the Jews being able to come out of the ghetto, and the growth of Zionism emanated from the non-religious areas. What was their theory? The theory was that we're the Jewish people, now we're free, but for us to really be free, and for us to recognize our potential as the Jewish nation, we need our own nation. wherever that might be. Israel seems like a logical choice, but perhaps other places would work as well. But that was led by the non-religious move. We're not going to have religion bind us, we're going to have the land bind us, in which case the religious people were like, well, we don't want anything to do with them. And particularly in Hungary, in some areas of the world, of Europe, they said, okay, you know, there's some of it good, some of it bad. There's many stories of the Nitziv was very excited about this, and the Beis HaLevi was involved. That's north. In as you go south, in Hungary, there was the theme from the Chassam Sofer of Chadash Aser Min HaTorah. They were vehement against any inroads of the Reform, both in the religious world as well as the Zionist world. So the religious world, perhaps some of those issues echo today with regards to any perhaps movement within a basic Knesset. So some of those halakhos became canonized at that time by saying that, no, we can't change anything, any move of anything in the shul is going to be, is going to lead us down the road to reform, and any changes we have to avoid as much as we can. So that perhaps is reason number two. I think reason number three is that Judaism is hard enough without having to worry about this extra mitzvah. It's hard enough trying to figure out how we're going to maintain our, just live anywhere in the world, much less going to this place that is empty and barren and very dangerous. We have enough trouble here. Let's figure out how we can maintain our lives here before we worry about these new things. And then there is the halachic underlying the underlying halachic structures that this is built upon, much of it surrounding a Gemara towards the end of Ksuvus. So there is a Gemara at the end of Ksuvus that based on a couple of psukim in Shir HaShirim that says, someone that name of Rabbi Yossi or Rabbi Chanina says that there are three shavuos, there are three oaths that were taken. What were they? So, Achash Shelo Yalu Yisrael B'choma. Number one is that the Jews should not go up. This is in the middle of much of the Gemara is about Eretz Yisrael are towards the end of Maseches Ksuvos. What are they doing at the end of Maseches Ksuvos? Well, because there's a Mishnah there that says that if one of the spouses say, I want to go, so the other one has to follow, and if they don't follow, so then they're responsible for destroying the marriage. So that's how you get into this discussion about the importance of Israel. So number one is that Bnei Israel should not go up as a wall. What does it mean as a wall? That's questionable, but that is historically been understood as in battle. With power and with an army. Va'achas sheyishpia Kadosh Baruch Hu es Yisrael shelo yimardu be'uma sa'olam. Number two is that Hashem made us promise that we're not going to undermine, we're not going to rebel against the other nations. Va'achas sheyishpia Kadosh Baruch Hu es ovdei kochavim shelo yishtabdu ben Yisrael yoter midai. That Hashem made the non-Jews swear that they weren't going to subjugate us more than necessary or excessively. So those are the three shavuos that are out there. Two of them binding on us, one of them binding on everyone else. And that, we could probably give a series about how to understand this. This is the premise of the anti-Zionist world. The Sefer Rebbe has Svarim built upon this Gemara, and defending it, and there's obviously reasons against it. This Gemara is not a secret to anybody. But this is the prime text for the machloket, the halachic machlokes over Zionism. So Zionism will just define as people taking the initiative and going to Israel and not waiting for Mashiach to all of a sudden appear and we're all just flying, all of a sudden finding ourselves in Israel with the base of Mikdash built. That's actually going to demand and require human initiative.
So the Goyim broke their oath.
Right. So one of the arguments on the to say these aren't binding is that the non-Jews broke their oath. In this case, we could break our oath as well. On the other hand, maybe yes, that is certainly that's a reason to say these are no longer binding. On the other hand, who says? Is that true? I mean, this was they broke their oath. This is we could break our oath. Not for tonight's year. I'm just putting the Gemara out there as the premise for the discussion that was going on. Yeah.
Was for going to Eretz Israel and he sent people to Eretz Israel.
Yes, there are many throughout history. There are many that were involved, including the Vilna Gaon and others. Yes, I agree totally. I'm not really for tonight's year though. Oh, this is as before this period. So the Rabbi Yisachar Shlomo Teichtal was born in the year 1885. He was born into this machlokes. 1885. His father was was a rabbi. Rabbi of a town. I don't think he was a rabbi of a town. I think he was just a learned individual. But he went to various yeshivas that people in that area of Europe went to. He ended up in Tzanz. He was somewhat of a Hasidish bent in Tzanz. He learned by Rav Moshe Greenwald. Rav Moshe Greenwald was the Rosh Yeshiva of Chust. So I think I've mentioned before, my grandfather, who grew up in Hungary, ended up in Chust. That's where he ended up before the war. His rabbi was Rav Yeshua. I'm not sure his. I never really heard this directly from him. But I can conjecture that Rav Yeshua Greenwald was the Rav of the town. He became, he was the grandson of Rav Moshe Greenwald. I think a couple of years ago on Pesach, we read some of his drushas. So that's, he learned there. He was involved with bells. He was probably mostly associated with Munkach. Munkach is known for perhaps second to Satmar for their anti-Zionism. It's another conjecture on my part, but my grandfather, when living in Borough Park, lived a couple blocks away from Anshei Svar. That's where he would daven regularly. That was a minion factory. A closer minion factory to his house was the Munkacher Beis Medrash. And we pass it pretty much on the way to shul. And there are minyanim. If you look on the board outside of the shul, minyan starts 6, 6:30, 7, 7:30, 8, 9:30, 8:39, and says ve'ilach. And from then on as well. And I don't believe my grandfather once stepped into the Munkacher Beis Medrash. He grew up a Munkach. He grew up in that environment. And after the war, he would not, I don't believe he would participate for that reason. And as a young man, between the ages of 24 and 36, he wrote his Sefer, what was perhaps he's most prominently known for outside of the Sefer called the Mishnah Sachir, which were his childhood tshuvos, which is pretty impressive for a 24-year-old person to getting questions and responding to them and writing a Sefer based on it. And he became the Rav of a town in Pištian, Czechoslovakia, which is north. So outside of, which is important, that it was not in Hungary, it was rather in Czechoslovakia, and happened to be a place that was near mineral baths, so a lot of rabbanim from all over Europe would end up in town, he would converse with them, and he became well known. He was certainly fit within that. You know, he was one of if Europe would have continued for another 2-3 decades, we probably would hear of him, just like we hear of Elchanan Wasserman and that people of that ilk. In 1938, the Nazis invaded Czechoslovakia, which was way before that was the first invasion. That's what started the whole started World War II. So he was there. He was living there. I don't know how large the Jewish community was, but the Nazis did not set up the final solution right away. They just invaded and made life miserable for the Jews there. So things were getting worse and worse and worse and worse. However, deportations didn't begin until 1942. So that's several years of living under Nazi rule. And the first deportation was young girls above the age of 16, and the story goes that him and I think 9 other families hid in the attic of the Beis Medrash, and he could look out the window, and he looked out the cracks of the wall and saw his congregants being dragged away and the yelling and screaming, and he took a neder at that time that if I live through this, or as I live through this, I will do something. I will write something in honor of Eretz Yisrael, and that's actually how he begins the books. Maybe we'll go off the biography for a moment. Go to the book on the source sheets. And source number 2 is the opening of the. This is the very first thing that he writes. Now, there is a first introduction, a second introduction, and a foreword. You don't get to the actual book until around page 90 or so in this book, and that's after many Roman numerals as well. But the very first line of the very first introduction says as follows: I discovered a letter written by the author of the Tanya to the Rebbe of Bardichev, informing him of his release from prison from Petersburg, and etc. And go to the underlined part. He says he has arranged this. Meaning the Rebbe said, he has arranged this by virtue of the merit of the Holy Land and its inhabitants. This is what stood at our side, will always assist in relieving us from the oppressor and delivering us from distress. I mean, because of the Holy Land. How many Jews were living in the Holy Land at that time? Not very many. So what does he mean that the Holy Land protected us? So that's what he works on in the very first section of his book. From his holy words, I learned an entirely new concept, which I was unaware until now. That is, when a Jew is in trouble, he can be saved through the merit of Israel and its inhabitants. So how does he? So he said, I was wondering if ever all my life I was wondering about this. Where did the Alter Rebbe get this from? And he says, I think I came across the pasuk. The pasuk tells us, it's a pretty famous pasuk. We read it as part of our Rosh Hashanah davening. There's a heart, the SBT, as Yitzchak, as Yaakov, the SBC Yitzchak, that was his BC Avram Eskor, via Aretz Eskor. That'll remember the bris with Yaakov, Yitzchak, and Avram, and it's in reverse order, and there's a whole understanding of what that is, and that the schus of Yaakov should save us, and Yitzchak and Avram, they should all be able to save us. And it sounds like, and if they don't, the Aretz Eskor, the land will provide for us. So he says, aha, that's my source. That in the schus, so therefore I'm doing this in the schus that will be able to, in the merit that will be saved, is in hopefully in the merit of Eretz. So also, I will write something in order to glorify, in order to glorify Eretz Yisrael. That's how he opens up his book. Now he continues on and says, this is I think already the second introduction. That's source three. So that was the top. Go to the bottom left. So it took a little manipulating to get this all on the page. If you go to the bottom left, so he writes the factors that prompted the writing of this volume. So he writes things that. It's a little contradictory. He says there's two issues that are going on now that are different than ever were before. So there's number one, that who has the time? I'm unable to go right now into learning normal halachic matters in my practice since my youth, since such study requires clarity. Meaning it's just been impossible for me to be able to learn, and therefore I'm going to, it sounds like, and therefore because I can't concentrate on that, I'm going to do the lighter subject matter of the things that I'm about to discuss now. That's the implication of that first paragraph. But then he goes on in the second paragraph and say, thus, I decided to examine the history of our people during 2,000 years, the Jewish spin, the destruction of the exile, lands and nations. I have never dealt in these types of questions since my youth. I've always been implanted in the house of God, hidden and concealed in the four cubits of Allah. Hashem has graciously allowed me to learn, teach, etc. I never took the time to concern myself with matters affecting the welfare of our holy nation, for this is a mitzvah that can be fulfilled by others. So he says, I never bothered wondering about national matters. I was always just dealing with halacha. I never worried about the entire Jewish people, as in where are we going as a nation, what are we all doing here. That wasn't ever my concern. So I'm going to deal with that now. So in a way, that's the opposite of what he says first. I mean, I'm unable to deal with halacha, so therefore I'm going to do something else. But I think he seems to be admitting that I really should have been doing this all along, or I didn't bother, but now I realize that this is something that I need to pay attention to. So there's somewhat conflicting reasons that he gives as the basis for this, but both of them could also be fitting together. So he also then adds in that right, this time you have to worry about the needs of Israel, and he thinks that the time of Mashiach has come. Now, something else that is unique is in section number 4, that he says the purpose of these tzaras that we're going to is to arouse us to return to Eretz Yisrael. That's what he writes. The sole purpose of all the afflictions that smite us in our exile is to arouse us to return to our holy land. That's a pretty amazing thought, to write that black on white. Now, maybe it's something in the water in Hungary, because the Sapir Rebbe was writing the exact opposite, that the reason that all these tsars are happening is because we became too connected to the Zionists, and that's why in Poland they're in so much more trouble than we are. That's why we're able to did a better job of defending ourselves against these inroads of the Tzionim, that's who he names, and that's why we're being protected more than others. Now, they ended up not being protected, but my school of thought is that we never say the reason for anything is always a dangerous place to go to. But he seemed to have a couple times over the course of the book, he writes it's obvious that this is the reason that such things are happening. And he also clearly was and he goes after the, and he says, and if you're going to learn this, and this is perhaps one of the most incredible things of what he writes, if you're going to learn this, you have to be able to come in with an open mind. Now, you realize what kind of switch this takes. For somebody, he's already an experienced Rav, he's the Rav of a Kehila, he's the Rav of a community, in the middle of where everybody else seems to be moving in one way, and he all of a sudden is changing his entire life, his entire perspective, and his entire connection to all of his colleagues that he knew. That's what, and he says, I just took a break and I looked, and this is clearly what needs to happen. So he writes in this paragraph, so, and if you're not going to come at this with an open mind, so then you're not going to get from it. And he says, who amongst us, the underlying part, who amongst us is greater than the spies? The Torah testifies they are proper individuals. Nevertheless, they were influenced by their desire for authority. That's the reason. And quotes in the footnote, there are a couple of opinions that make that claim, that they had positions, they were the spies, they were pretty important people, and their concern was, we're going to go into the land of Israel, and we're going to lose all of our prestige. Now, does that mean that they said it openly? Not necessarily. We don't read that they said it openly. But underlying everything was that. So he says, the same holds true in the next paragraph. The same holds true for our times, even amongst rabbis, rebbes, and chassidim. This one has a good rabbinical position. This was an established admor. This one has a professional business or factory or prestigious job which provides great satisfaction. They are afraid that their status will decline if they go to Eretz Yisrael. That is a pretty sharp critique. Perhaps maybe the strongest critique that you can make of a group, but that's what he says. And he says the most of the time, and he says in a hesped that was given for Rav Meir Shapiro. Now, Rav Meir Shapiro didn't die much before this. This is Rav Meir Shapiro died in the early 35. Yeah, so that means that this was 7 years before. But he says that most of the time a person feels himself and thinks he acts for the sake of heaven. In reality, though, he is controlled by his deep rooted motives. So that is his accusation that he is casting out. And now he did say, I meant to mention this before, as an example of things that he wrote, so the most prominent thing, I actually emailed with Rabbi Lichtman, I asked him if he knew of any other positions that he had other than this line, but this is the line that gets quoted. Apparently he wrote once in a Munkach newspaper that Zionism is a, quote, a desecration of holiness and a defilement, well, the quote was in Yiddish, but you know, it's a desecration of holiness and a defilement of the supernal and the earthly holy land. That's the line that gets quoted about what he said, which was the standard thought of the time. So towards the end of his book, he makes the following he says, I've heard many people try to defame me because of a letter I wrote in Tikkun Olam, published by the Holy Rebbe of Munkach. For in that letter, I spoke out against Aliyah, while now I advocate. However, the preceding idea resolves the contradiction quite well. When I wrote the letter, it was a time of peace and tranquility. We had not yet reached a state of mortal danger. Now, however, time has changed. Therefore, the ruling has also changed, as the above cited shall demonstrate. Now, that's not exactly so great. Was he saying, well, I was right then and I'm right now. It's just the circumstances changed. But he said, no, besides this, I already explained in the introduction that I never delved deeply into the issue. Now that I worked on it, I was able to come to the conclusion of what I'm right. What I never really identified. What? That we should all make our greatest efforts to go to Israel, settle the land, and bring Mashiach. That's the goal of the book, and that's what we're supposed to do. Now, he wrote this, we realize. He wrote this really without sources. I don't say without sources at all. The legend is that he wrote it in an attic without any sources. It's not completely true. He wrote it in that attic. After a few months, he got word from a Rav where do I have it here? A Rav in Nitra, a Nitra in Slovakia, that he could come. So he went with his family to Nitra. Then the Nazis came into Nitra. The Tatars fled to Hungary. He goes from place to place, first in Budapest and then the area surrounding Budapest. And that's actually where he completed the book. So there were times he left the attic, he went to other places, he did have access to Sfarim, but despite even with a full library, to write the amount of Bekiyas, the amount of sources that he quotes here, is mind-boggling. And he certainly wasn't learning it during that time, which actually gives you I thought about this for a moment, that for many people, how do we interpret coming to a certain conclusion? We normally interpret it as, okay, so I learn, and ultimately I come to a conclusion. He did learn, and never came to the conclusion until he took a step back and thought about it. I mean, all these sources are things that he knew already, and then he never thought of it under that perspective until it came time to, okay, now I'm going to have a change of heart, I'm going to think about things differently. Now, he writes in the middle of this book, really an amazing thing, that he would go around in Hungary. Now, Hungary was difficult, but it was still livable for Jews. He would go around from shul to shul, and they say, "Ah, the Halug Rav is here. Let's give a drasha, give a shir, get up and speak." So they beg him, and they get up and speak, and he writes. They advertised, and everybody was etc. And then they came up to me 10 minutes before and said, "Listen, as long as you get up to speak, we really want to hear your shir. Just don't mention any of that Eretz Yisrael stuff. It's not really going to go over here." And then he continues on for a few minutes. That's ridiculous, and that's terrible, and how could it be? And that's what led us down this road, and etc. So he. So one of the big challenges that he deals with over the course of the one of the big complaints against the Zionist movement was it's being run by the non-religious. That the non-religious, how is it possible that this is the building of the, this is the Reishis Michas Gula Seinu, this is the beginning of the redemption? How is it possible if it's all being done with non-religious people? So he quotes, that's the top, in source number 7, he quotes from the Gemara in Masechta Sanhedrin, that Rabbi Yochanan says, why did Omri deserve kingship? Anybody remember who Omri is? Omri was Ahab's father. So Omri and Ahab both lived for a long time. And the Pasuk actually says about Omri that he did worse things than anybody else ever did. He did worse than any of the kings before him. He did even worse. And yet the Gemara says, why did he get such a long reign? And his children got such a long reign. How'd that happen? So he says, because he added a city to the land of Israel. What does he mean? So he quotes here from the Tana Devei Eliyahu, that Eliyahu Navi, was sitting in a study. I asked, why is it the other kings were not succeeded by their sons while Omri had 3 of his descendants inherit his throne? They replied, we don't know. I said to my masters, it's because he added a great city to the land of Israel. Omri thought, just as Jerusalem is the capital of the city of Judah, so will Shomron be the capital of the kings of Israel. But what Taital then continues on and says, but you see, even non-religious people get praised for their building in the land of Israel. And he goes after the religious even more and says, you know, they're doing it because you're not doing it. You didn't go, so therefore they're going to go ahead and take control. I just finished reading Like Dreamers, so he quotes from in the book. Like Dreamers is the book written by Yosef Klein Halevi. Yeah, so he traces several members of the 55th Brigade who all went in totally different directions. You read it? Who all went in different directions over the course of their life. So one of the characters that he follows is Rav Yoel ben Nun, who was a member of the Brigade and then became one of the first people to buy a house in by Har Etzion in Alun Shvut, right? And then was in Ofra. It follows his story, but it describes him as he was in the army in 1967. He was right out of yeshiva, right out of Merkas Harav, where that was what Rav Kook preached. Rav Kook preached, and that's why he got attacked. That we have to work with the non-religious in order to build up the land. And he describes as he's walking up the hill through to the Lion's Gate, about to get onto Har Habayis. He's like he couldn't believe it, that all the teachings that he's heard from all of his youth are all coming true, as him, a religious soldier, is marching with the non-religious soldiers into Yerushalayim Eir HaKadosh, and onto Har Habayis. Like, that was just like mind-boggling for him. That's what he describes. But the truth is that right-wing world, much of it has come around to that perspective these days. The disimportance of Kiruv, and we have to catch, you know, try to get every Jew, and do outreach, etc. But that wasn't, the term outreach was not a term 50, 60 years ago. It wasn't an ideal. It was, let's close ranks, build walls, and whoever's in, whoever's out is out, and we're not worried about them. So this is quite a concept, but he continues on and makes a plea to the non-religious, and says, you know, yeah, you realize that it's not going to work. Realize that, yes, we perhaps owe you a debt of gratitude for all that you've done and that you've sacrificed and all that, but if you're not going to base your movement on Torah, so it's not going to work. You're not going to be able to continue. It says that all of us must realize that the rebuilding, the governing, and all aspects of life must be founded on the spirit of our holy Torah. Only then will we succeed. Now let's just skip 9 for a second and go to source number 10, right below it. He says, I found in Osef Michtavim, a collection of letters from the Rebbe, from the Ger Rebbe. Now, this is also not of the Big Tzionim. But this indeed is my opinion. The mitzvah of Yishev Eretz Yisroel, which our Holy Torah commands us, not depend on a specific time, only on capabilities and opportunities. Therefore, we must take advantage of today's opportunity and exert all of our strength for this mitzvah. The more Orthodox Jews that ascend to Eretz Yisroel, the greater their influence will be. And this will help preserve the holiness of the land land. In this way, Orthodox Judaism's influence will grow, and the settlement of the Holy Land will be founded on the spirit of our holy written Torah. Meaning, if you want Eretz Yisrael, you want Israel to be a religious country, so get involved and make it a religious country. I remember a couple of years ago when the whole... I'm trying to think if I'm allowed to share this. This is shared in private conversation, so I won't go there. but that this is something that continues to and you see it today. You see it goes up and it goes down and it ebbs and flows. But you see, as the army ranks in Israel have become more and more filled with religious people, things have changed. Now there's pushback and there's push forward and there's challenges, etc. But as more have gotten involved, it really is amazing of what the religious nature that the country now has, which was from his perspective, it was prophecy in the 40s to be able to make that claim that the land of Israel will ultimately be governed in a continuation, ultimately get to people who are religious, is a pretty amazing feat. That would takes a lot of perspective to be able to see from back then. He adds in reasons for suffering. Now he takes as we said before, that he said, "Oh, the reason we're suffering here is because we didn't go." He also then says that that suffering is necessary for a redemption to take place. Now, that is also a scary thing. That is not so easy to accept, certainly here while we're in this country. But he says that it's necessary. There needs to be suffering for redemption. Why? He says it's obvious. He says, the underlying part, "Now if the redemption would occur while we live prosperously and tranquilly amongst the nations, there would be many, many of our Jewish brethren who would not want to leave." Yeah? Right? Makes sense. What are they lacking in exile? They are wealthy and prominent officers amongst the nations, the Rothschilds, the Jewish barons, who attain distinction and honor, rising to positions of authority and prestige. Why should they care about Mashiach and Eretz Yisrael? They have a Mashiach in Yerushalayim right here. They do not need a better Mashiach than the one they have. This indeed is what the wealthy Jews of Ezra's time did when they dwelt peacefully in Babel. They didn't go back. Now, you could think, I was asked recently, what happened to all those Jews that stuck around in Babel? I mean, if he only took a small percentage to build Bayit Sheni, what happened to all those Jews in Babel? So, one of two things happened, right? Either they disappeared. We follow Jewish history from that point forward in Bayit Sheni. That's the part that's prominent. By Bayit Sheni, and then the Mishnah, and the Gemara, and then people were taken in exile, and we get to, and then the Gemara happens in Babel again. Now, were the people that stayed in Babel a continuation of those Jews from Bayit Rishon? Probably some, probably to some extent, but they also disappear from history for a couple hundred years. So, that's what to think about. So, he takes a moment in the beginning of his introduction. He says, by the way, why did I name the Sefer Ima Banim Smecha? Some may recall, I think we spoke about this, I forget if it was on Pesach or if it was on Sukkot. But he tells you the story as why he says Ima Banim Smecha. That the Ima Banim Smecha, is there a city here? The mother of the children rejoice. That's what the name means. It's taken from Hallel. Ema banim smecha, hallelujah. So he writes that that when he was still in his town, there was a parent who there was a father who tried taking all of the children, all the daughters. He was going to take them over the border into Hungary. And the plan was when he got into Hungary, they were going to send the telegram back to the wife saying that we got there safely, that everything is okay. So this happened right before Pesach, or going on to Pesach. So Chol Hamoed Pesach comes, the mother's waiting for her telegram, and instead she gets a message that the husband was taken captive, that he was caught trying to cross the border with all of the daughters. Then, 2 days later, a rav of the town near where he was captured was able to lie, cheat, steal, bribe, was able to get him out. And they're able to come back. And he describes in the introduction that the joy that this mother felt, the joy that this woman felt upon seeing her husband and her children, I could only imagine that's the joy that the land of Israel is going to feel when finally the children come home. Now I think about it, I think I mentioned this when I was in Russia. The very next line in Hallel is Betzeis Yisrael Mitzrayim, right? That we felt this joy upon leaving Egypt. Where were they the next day after they left Egypt? They're in the middle of the desert, not having any clue about how they're going to survive. What's going to be, right? They're complaining about water, they're complaining about mud, and they're complaining about the Egyptians that are chasing them down, and then they get saved again, and then they're dumped back in the desert, and now they're still in the desert, they still don't know how to, and they complain again, etc., etc. So, yes, it's true that the amount of joy is amazing, but one also has to, sometimes the argument is, well, what do we really achieve? There's so much more that needs to happen. Yes, it's true we have the land, but there's no Beis HaMikdash. Yes, it's true we have the land, but there's still all this problem with all these other religious Jews, etc. But realize that there is a next step. There is a next step. You could be joyous at one step, while still recognizing that there are more steps that are going to come. Now, at the end of the book, the very last paragraph of the book, and I don't know why he kept this a secret, but at the end of the book he says, at this time, at the completion of the printing, I'll make it known that the incident mentioned at the end of the second introduction happened to me, that I was the guy. I was the man who went with my wife, and I went with my daughters, and was saved, and was able to come back, and that's how he recognized it. Why it was a secret, I'm not sure, but that is part of the legend that is included in the book.
So he never made it to Israel?
No, he never made it. So the story, so ultimately, he was, when the Nazis invaded Hungary, he actually went back to Nitra. He went back because he figured that, well, maybe they already cleaned up there and nobody's there anymore. So he went back to where he was, hoping that he'd be safe. He was captured. He was sent to Auschwitz. He actually he was in Auschwitz for, it sounds like, 9 months or so, and then he was included on as the if you're in Auschwitz, the Russians, as the Russians were coming, so Auschwitz was evacuated. They sent a bunch of people on trains and a bunch of people on death marches. So he was on a train, and what the Nazis would do is they would take some breadcrumbs and they'd throw it to the Jews and watch them fight. So he got his own piece, he ate his piece, and then he realized that there was a Ukrainian that was stealing from another Jew. So he got up and got into, getting involved, and he was beaten and killed at the spot. He was offered, he did give a few last words that are mentioned here, I think. No. Maybe it's something I listened to that mentions what his last words were, but that is the story. I can only imagine what we would. There is a, I should mention this in the middle of the shir, but Rabbi Lichtman, I listened to one of his shirim that he gave when he toured the country after writing his introduction. So he told the story that when that a member of his shul in Beit Shemesh, an old member of his shul, he said when he was sitting Shiva, somebody came from his shul and told him the story that he was walking, in Mei Sharim, and he asked, he went over to somebody and said, Masha'a, what is the time? To which the person responded saying, I won't speak that treif language. So he started talking, I don't know, talking, arguing, whatever, but they started talking, and he ultimately said, what's your name? And I forget the name, but he said his last name was Teichtal. He said, are you related to Rav Shlomo Yisachar Teichtal? And he said, yeah, it's my grandfather. He says, how is it possible that the grandchild of the Eim Von Smeichet just said what you said? To which he said, well, we have a Masorah in the family that he went crazy. So that's the paragraph. That's what he was talking about. Either you can accept and you can open your eyes, or one can stay and just and deny and continue in their path.
The other thing he pushed in the book, I mean, I felt, was that part of the problem, part of the reason that maybe we got to this point is because, you know, even though he felt like the Jews who were not religious needed to learn to become religious, that people needed to work together.
Yep.
I mean, and I think that was a really big part of what he was writing.
Sure.
Also.
Sure.
That you can't simply, and that was why we were in the trouble we were in. I mean,
yeah, that's what he writes, but that is a complete paradigm shift from everybody else that he encountered.
And he spent so much of the book defending how he got to that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
So
we've been reading.
Yep.
So did he? I don't know the time frame of Rav Kook. Did he influence or was it?
They overlap, but I doubt that they met. I mean, Rav Kook was Northern Europe, Lithuania,
so then
and then ended up in Israel. I don't think so. No, there are some remarkable connections to Rav Kook. I doubt he met him or read his writings, because by the time he was thinking in this way, he was already in the middle of the Holocaust.
Right.
The other thing that's remarkable is that we often associate the essay of Kol Dodi Dofeik, the imagery of the beloved knocking on the door that the Rav Soloveitchik uses for his essay about Israel. He has the same paragraph. He uses the same imagery. He quotes the same psukim and the same midrashim that the Rav used to describe that. So the Rav is perhaps more prominent. His is also he uses the same connection. So there's a lot of connections there that he writes.
Rabbi Rakefet.
What?
He has
children that are I've heard that there are children. There are also children that are Tzionim, I've heard.
Yes.
But no.
Did his son write one of the introductions or something?
Yes.
Was instrumental in getting it published in the first book.
Right.
Yes.
The one that.
Yes.
I don't know if that's the son of the grand.
No, it was the son.
I don't know if that was the son.
Where the family
grandchild.
Okay,
yeah. I mean that
would. Yeah, Rabbi Rakefet points out that he thinks that those three, the idea of three shvuos, the idea that we quoted in the beginning, is based on the idea of hishbati aschem. I made you swear. It's based on pasuk in Shir HaShirim. So he thought that maybe that's why the Rav and Rav Taital, that's why they went back to Shir HaShirim to get the counterforce. I mean, for the same source that you're using, we'll use the same source to show against. But that's a theory that he has. Okay? All right. So thank you for coming.
Say the rap.